because everybody was scrambling. People were, had sort of entered the airbase. People were stealing stuff. They had scaled the walls. And it was complete chaos at the time. And I remember one night, the fighting was so intense. It was so intense. I could hear it was very close to where that fighting was happening. And I could hear the bombs, the mortars, and like, you know, those... Even when I talk about it, I get goosebumps that, you know, there was like, I could hear the shelling and it was just so loud, so clear after. And each night, that entire night, I was like, okay, there's going to be an airstrike and this is it. It's done. I'm done. It's finished. Kehte hai, don't worry. It's not so close. It's very far. If you had come a week before, they were fighting right outside our house. Uski jagah mein. I need some... And suddenly, bahar na afra-tafri shuru ho jati hai, corridor mein. And then she gets up and then somebody just bursts into the room. And because they were talking in Pashto or Dari, I couldn't tell. But they were talking in their tongue and I couldn't understand. All I could hear is, Taliban is here.
Hi Kanika, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
I want to understand that you are a journalist, a woman journalist, in fact, who's been covering conflicting zones like Afghanistan, Lebanon, sometimes in Sri Lanka and India as well. What is your take on the current scenario regarding the foreign minister of Taliban, Muktaki, not allowing women journalists in the press conference and then later saying that it was not intentional?
So, it's for me, I think it's... that this is something I have actually tweeted about as well, that what Taliban has done in India is not out of character. What they normally have, it's very close to their ideology. They have a misogynistic ideology, which they have eventually kind of followed, regardless of what the reasons they have given. The point is that they did not allow women journalists to be a part of the conference, of the press conference. But I think the bigger question here is about us as in India. You know, like, this is our country. We value constitutional, you know, freedoms. We value equal access to all the journalists. Then why did we not, you know, raise enough questions as to how can they sort of pick and choose who gets to attend the conference and who doesn't get to attend the conference? And then the reason next day is saying allegedly that it's because of some technical issue. Well, only the female journalists were left out due to the technical issue. It's very convenient as an excuse. So I believe my take here is that the Taliban were very close or very much on brand their ideology. What I think the failure here was ours. We should have been the ones fighting it more, like harder. And I'm very glad, I mean, the way people have fought back, I mean, the journalists have fought back and they did get the seat at the table, which makes me believe that if we make enough noise and the right kind of noise on certain topics, it does get noticed. So
they also, I'm paraphrasing a statement that they said that Islam protects the rights of women. But when it comes to Afghanistan, after sixth grade, girls are taken out of schools. There are no job reservations for women. In fact, there aren't any opportunities for them to not only study further, but work further or have any basic rights. So what is your state on that?
Based on what I have spoken with, and that's many, many, many experts about this whole ideology of Islam not allowing women to study, is a misrepresentation, according to the scholars, of course, who have told me, because they have explained what education essentially means. And what the Taliban believes also, again, it's not a question of right or wrong at this point. The question is, what they believe is that the education should be in line with Islam. Now, we are in modern times. The Afghan women have tasted, or the girls, Afghan girls have tasted freedom for 20 years. They have had equal opportunities. They were holding, you know, positions of power in Afghan Republic government. They were working as journalists. They were working as media professionals. They were working as photographers, videographers. They were doing all sorts of things. And even when I've traveled deep inside Afghanistan, villages as well, families, at least, even despite it being a very conservative environment, parents were still open, you know, to the idea that their girls should study. As long as there is an opportunity available, the parents will eventually open up their minds to that possibility. But that door has now been closed. And female population in Afghanistan is about 50%. So which is like, if there is a 38 million people in Afghanistan, half of that is all women and girls and young girls, and who are basically looking at, you know, a future where there is no way out. There's no way out at all. I mean, I have spoken to so many girls. I was reporting when the education ban was announced. I was in Kabul at the time and I reported on that incident from the on the from the ground, and I know how many girls were just they were just crying. They heard about the horror stories, you know, from their mothers who had lived through the first era of the 5 years that Taliban was in power in 1996 to 2001. They did live through that era, and they remember it, and they would talk about it in, you know, in a way like, these are horror stories from the past, and I hope that you never get to experience it. But their children are experiencing it right now. You know, that access, that lack of access, that fear, and that, you know, that muzzling. They cannot have any presence whatsoever, which I think in today's time and age, it's obnoxious. And that the world, we really need to pull the world's attention to this issue is even more frustrating, I think, as a journalist, that we have to continue pulling that attention.
You said you were in Kabul at the time when the education ban was announced. So you've been a ground reporter in Afghanistan for quite some time. What are some anecdotal evidences that you can share with us? Because you've been there up close and personal with Taliban.
So I think the first time I went there was 2019. That was as a travel. I was very fascinated by this neighboring country, or supposedly neighboring country that we had. And I did not know that the visa between India and Afghanistan was free. I just had a friend who we were connected. We met in Europe once, and we were just generally talking about Afghanistan. I was very intrigued by it. And I was like, oh, is it like people do normally actually even go there? And he's like, of course, yeah, people come all the time and people travel. And I was like, really? I mean, is that even possible? And then I applied. And then, you know, just like that, we applied for the visa, got the visa in 5 days, 10 days, whatever, however long it took. And then I traveled. It all happened within a matter of 15 days. And then I spent 10 days in Kabul and a bit in eastern Afghanistan. And I was fascinated the culture and how kind people were to me as an Indian. They were talking to me in Urdu or Hindi, if you will, because of Bollywood. They watched our dramas, they watched our shows, they listened to our music. Even a very busy market in Kabul was playing those 80s Bollywood songs. And I was like, what, did I even leave my country? Like, everybody's talking in Urdu or Hindi, and everybody's playing Bollywood music, and it felt like home. And then I left, and then of course the COVID happened and everything. And then 2021, the opportunity arose, and I went back again. I think at the time the situation was really evolving in Afghanistan, and I went as a tourist, but I decided to stay longer and apply for a permit to work there as a journalist, which I did get. It was very difficult to get that permit, but I did get eventually. And then I ended up just sticking around. And then I saw right from the moment when Biden announced that we are pulling our forces from Afghanistan to the time when they actually did pull out from Afghanistan, I witnessed it all in front of me. It was, I've never seen something fall so quickly. Like, it was like a house of cards. So I think the arrangement was that by the end of August, the Americans or the NATO.
2021,
yeah. 31st August, 2021 was the final last date when they were supposed to leave the country in full. And we were, of course, since we were on the ground, and by then I was reporting quite actively on the developments of what was happening in Afghanistan. So I was noticing or observing how the states or the provinces, as they call it, were falling one after another. When I say falling provinces, it means it was being captured by Taliban in a fiery speed. Like, it was unbelievable that one day we are watching that, oh, this province has fallen. The next day we are watching this province has fallen, even without a fight. So it was quite an experience. And then the most interesting one was when I was in Bagram. Bagram is a very strategic air base in Afghanistan, an American air base in Afghanistan. And I was there to talk to the governor, because there were talks about, of course, that the Americans are leaving. What's going to happen now? How are you going to hold secure power here? How are you going to ensure safety of people and things like that? I had the meeting with the, I'm forgetting who exactly, but someone really senior in at the base. And when I arrived at Bagram, it was just... You know, everybody was scrambling. Everybody, including the governor that I was to meet, he was scrambling, and everything was just like, people were going haywire. Everything was going haywire. And I was like, what's happening? And then they told me that the Americans have left. I mean, overnight, just like that, they just turn off the power in Bagram, and they just left. That was shocking, because a country just doesn't up and leave. You know, there are protocols, there are processes that you follow. I don't know, I'm not aware of the exact protocol, but it was bizarre, because everybody was scrambling. People had sort of entered the air base, people were stealing stuff, they had scaled the walls, and it was complete chaos at the time. And And then somehow, I mean, I think I went back to Kabul, and then I came back again the following day to sort of go inside the base to get to, you know, to get a look inside what was left behind. And then I saw, I entered the base, and it was humongous, like humongous. I've never seen something so huge, like right from the outer perimeter to the probably like just maybe one, it was like an onion, you know, layers after layers after layers. So probably on the first layer of that onion, it took me about 15 to 20 minutes to get there. And once we got there, and then I started looking around, I started looking into the cabins of people where they were staying and what kind of life they had. The food was, you know, all completely rotten. It was rotting because they cut the power, and there's a country, you know, which is hungry outside, and you couldn't have given that food. So these were the things that we were talking about quite loudly, you know, like this was the food you could have donated, or there must have been ways. I don't know how you do these things, but there must have been ways on a more humanitarian level. So this was like, these are just some of the instances I remember off the top of my head. And then there was Kandahar, which is like the seat of power for the Taliban. I went there because there was a lot of internal displacement of of people happening because of, you know, how the fight was going on between the National Army and the Taliban. And every evening at 6 o'clock, they'll just cut the power. So that was how Kandahar was. Like at six in the evening, the power would be gone. And I was staying with a local family over there. They were a friend's friend, and they were very nice. They took me in, and I stayed there. I stayed with them for like 2-3 days, and they were, and then we used to sleep on the terrace. And I remember one night, the fighting was so intense. It was so intense. I could hear, it was very close to where that fighting was happening, and I could hear the bombs, the mortars, and like, you know, those, even when I talk about it, I get goosebumps that, you know, there was like, I could hear the shelling, and it was just so loud, so clear after. And each night, that entire night, I was like, okay, there's going to be an airstrike, and this is it. It's done. I'm done. It's finished for me. You know, when we were sleeping under the open sky, there is no protection whatsoever. It's dark. Their phones are not working. The family is sleeping. They're sleeping. Okay, they become so, I don't know, immune, if this is for the lack of better word, they've become so immune to that that life that it did not surprise them. Because I remember I was very tired at around 8 or 9 in the evening. And I told the family, and they had like a lot of children in the house. They had like 10, 15 children. So I was very friendly with all of them. And I would spend like, you know, my time playing with the children. Around 8 or 9, I was like really tired because I had spent a full day reporting. So I was like, you know what, I'm going to go and crash. So they set a bed for me on the terrace, and I went upstairs. And then this whole fighting thing started. And then I ran downstairs. I was like, upar to patake baj rahe hain yaar. Matlab, they spoke Urdu also. Like, upar to patake baj rahe hain. So, kehte hain, don't worry. It's not so close. It's very far. If you had come a week before, they were fighting right outside our house. Like, what is, at what point do you people think that you are in real danger? Yeah. Like, they took it so calmly that this happens every day. Just ignore it. You'll be fine. Don't worry. And then the women, they kind of grabbed me, and then they put like mehndi on my hands, and then, you know, like that's a Pashto tradition, yeah, putting mehndi on my feet and on my hands, and like go sleep, it's going to be fine, you'll be fine next morning. And then I think the whole night, obviously I didn't sleep because it was like mortars. And I think around 4, I something in me told me that it's going to stop with Fajr ki azan, like the first azan in the morning, and precisely at 4 o'clock it stopped. And I think I must have slept for 2 hours. And then I was like, I ran to the airport. I was like, I need to get the hell out of here, because I, as an independent journalist, I have no protection. Nobody knew that I was there. Because I wanted to keep a very low profile. The Danish Siddiqui incident had just happened. You know, the Reuters journalist who was assassinated in Spin Buldak in Kandahar. It had just happened. So I wanted to keep a very low profile as an Indian. So I think I did some very stupid shit when I was there, you know. But yeah, lived it long enough to tell the tale.
Getting goosebumps. Yeah, no. But as a senior journalist, I do want to understand that, do you feel in the coming years and in the recent years, the relationship between the Afghanistan government, which is Taliban now, and the Indian government is strengthening?
I think yes, there's a lot of strategic you know, advantage for being friends with Afghanistan. That's why we were friends for like so long. I mean, India, with the Republic, India had a very close tie with Afghanistan. We had invested a lot in a lot of their projects. We had built roads. We have invited their students, their youth to India to study here. And a lot of the Afghans used to study here as well. So there was a lot of cultural exchange. We had a lot of soft power in that sense, that we had movies, we had music, we had dramas, we had cultural exchange. There is gratis visa arrangement between India and Afghanistan. It still is, you know, by the way. So we always had a very strategic presence over there. But going back, like really far back, India's experience with Taliban was not so great, as we all know, with history, with, the Kandahar airplane hijack and whatnot. Like, historically, we didn't share a very good relationship with them. But today, as of today, 2025, the situation, the global situation is very different. It's not what it used to be. And I think, originally, I think India does, I see that India will have a very deep ties with Afghanistan, as is also visible with Muttaqi's visit to India. Like UN sanction was temporarily suspended just so he could travel to India. So these things, I think, globally people are watching. We haven't recognized them yet, but there is very active diplomacy happening. So
you've also worked in Lebanon, right? And the Lebanon economic crisis is one of the worst economic crises in modern history. What's your opinion on it as someone who's reported from the ground?
So Lebanon was a very exciting experience. It was my first entry into Middle East. I only just spent 2 weeks over there, 10 of which were basically just me sitting in the apartment because it was Christmas and everything was closed. So any real actual work that I did, I actually only just did in the last 5 days that I was there. But the good thing is that the country received me so well that it was only within a matter of 5 to 7 days, I had built good networks over there, and I was able to kind of go deep into the South Asian diaspora. That was the chunk of my reporting over there. I was speaking to a lot of South Asians. I was speaking to Bangladeshis, Sri Lankans, Indians, and Pakistanis. I was speaking to a lot of, South Asian people to understand what brings them to Middle East. Why did they stay? That was the crux of my reporting. Then as for the economic crisis, I could not quite go much into it because I did not spend that much time. But my observations anecdotally were that the one thing I think I've spoken about enough is that the country does not have electricity. Yes. It was baffling to me that I come from India and we have electricity, and then we have all the amenities. It's just so bizarre that a country like a proper functioning sovereign state would not have something as basic as electricity. Mm-hmm. And every day their currency loses value. Yeah. Today it's X Lebanese pound. Tomorrow the $1 equals X Lebanese pound. Tomorrow it's
like
Y.
Wow.
Yeah. It just keeps dropping. And I'm like, everything is incredibly expensive. Even when I would go buy groceries and I was only there for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Even for those 2 weeks, I spent like a good amount of money on groceries. It was so expensive. The milk was expensive. So if someone who is traveling from outside is feeling the pinch of the price, I wonder what it's like for the people who live
but
there.
As of October 2025, their GDP is 4.7%, and like they credit a lot of it to tourism as well. What do you think are some of the plausible solutions that can help them get out of this economic crisis?
I'm way out of my depth to answer that question. I wouldn't know. Because I'm not very well versed with their economic crisis. I know in passing, but I think we'll not be able to comment on it.
So as someone who worked in Middle East and Lebanon and as a South Asian journalist, what do you think is a global perspective of Indian journalists out there?
We as South Asians, and this is something I have been talking about quite a bit, that we as South Asians or Indians or South Asians, we don't have the passport privilege. And what is a double whammy for me is that I'm also a freelancer. So that makes access all the more difficult for me and even more challenging. So speaking very, very specifically to Lebanon, when I was there, so I had one publication support my travel. As a freelancer, we need those letters. We need support, some support from publications. And there was a publication that was kind enough to give me that support system. But it's an online publication. So the Lebanon has a strange policy, media policy, that unless your publication is print or TV, we do not give you permission to report. And now I am currently in Lebanon, in Beirut. spending my own money every day in a very expensive country, a tiny country, but a very expensive one, I don't have reporting permit. And I'm wondering that, okay, now I'm here, what do I do? How do I recover my losses, if you will? And that, I think, puts me in, put told me even more that as an Indian, how much of a privilege we do not have. Because I know that a colleague, some French journalist I knew, also went there, also in the same situation as me, but got the permit. We were like a couple days apart from each other, but they got the permit.
I think this is very contrary. I really have to point that out, because I term myself as an independent but international journalist, since most of my work experience comes from Germany or internationally. And I have really noticed that the West or a lot of the so-called developed countries are eyeing India like anything. They're desperate to get Indian stories. They are like financing them left, right, and center. Okay. But still the point is that the journalists are cribbing because they're not getting what they deserve. If I was doing the same thing in a Western country, I would be paid more, I would get more rights, I would be appreciated more, even though no one really cares much about what is happening in the West on ground level. They care more as opinionated pieces or deep research, case studies, things like that, or even documentary. But like stories that are coming out from on ground, so-called stories, are Indian diaspora related and Indian subcontinent related. And I, this is why I think that this is so contrary, because you are dying to enter here, but the second we want to do something which is more like a cross culture, or we are like, we also want to expand our information, so somehow we are stopped.
That's the passport that we are talking about, you know, the access that we are talking about. And adding on to your point and how desperate they are to enter India, but again, as a freelancer, and now that you're also working here, you would also know that a lot of the editors that we work with on a regular basis, especially I, who I have worked with some editors on a very, very regular basis, they say that we feel overwhelmed by the number of pitches we receive from India, because there are so many freelancers, so many of us, and I feel like we are all scrambling for the same resources. You know, those resources are so limited. There is probably one good publication that allows you that creative freedom, but then there are 30 of us or 40 of us or hundreds of us who are trying to eye the same publication. It's just this, you know, then you try to sort of branch out. You say, okay, fine, since there are so many people who are very good at what they do, and they want to, they probably are the right people to tell the story from India or whatever, and then you try to branch out. Okay, fine, let me look at South Asian interest outside of India. And then you're stopped. That is very frustrating. You can't work here, you can't work outside. So where do you work? So what, like, should I just stop being a journalist now because it's just too hard, quote unquote? I mean, it's like you keep, I mean, I, for one, I feel myself like I'm chasing my own tail, because it's like, for example, just yesterday when this whole press conference situation, you know, it really, I'm very glad that people were very loud and vociferous about Taliban. You don't get to call shots in India.
Yeah,
you know, it's one thing you do in your country, you have jurisdiction, you are the de facto government. Okay, it's not right, but okay. In India, we have constitutional freedoms. We still view women as equal. We still value their equal participation in every walk of life. So you can't tell us that our women will not be allowed in the room. So I'm very happy about that, that people raised enough voice. And in, almost within 24 hours, that decision was overturned. And they did invite female journalists. But I had to watch it from the sideline. Even for someone who has worked on Afghanistan for so long, I have worked on it for 4 years now, two of which I spent there, and 2 years that I was there on the ground, and 2 years that I have been working remotely. I felt so distraught that I was not in the room to ask those questions. You know, that I had burning questions to ask the foreign minister about so many things, that they evade us on the phones. It's near impossible to get through to them. It's just, it felt like I had so much to ask, but I had to, helpless. You know, I felt helpless that this is my country, my home, my ground turf. I'm in Delhi. It's not even I'm outside of Delhi. And yet I have to watch it from the sidelines. It was, I think it left it left that very frustrating, indelible mark on me that, okay, we got to fight that.
No, but I understand, like, as you were talking about women in journalism and the jurisdiction that Taliban comes from, it's like their right to do whatever they want in a country that they are governing, right? But I want to understand that what we as outsiders, because I would still call myself as an outsider, though I'm a journalist, because I'm not on ground. And I think it's very, anybody who's not on ground is always alien. So is it actually that bad for the women in Afghanistan? Do you think that there is some solution-oriented results that Taliban can actually bring in or are bringing in, or the women of Afghanistan can do to make their lives better?
So, okay, the situation for women in Afghanistan is obviously really bad. There's plenty that's been said. There's plenty that I have reported on also. Their basic freedoms, none of it exists. The freedoms that you and I enjoy, the freedom to go out, the freedom to work, the freedom to talk to a male colleague or a non-related man, you know, like just talk. That is also not allowed. Case in point being, I was just reporting on the earthquakes that happened in East Afghanistan, and one of the things that came up a lot was how is aid being delivered to female-led households, because a lot of the men in Eastern Afghanistan have perished in wars, in hunger, in, I don't know, wars from the airstrikes or whatever. Like, you know, over the years, there have been a lot of homes that have no male, you know, family member. So how is aid reaching them? And that is actually a point considered by, you know, by the people who are working, the international NGOs who are working on the ground, that, okay, how do we target, you know, non-male led or female led households in that belt? Because one, it's culturally very conservative, which means that not anybody can just walk in and say that, hey, here, food for you and your children. Even if it's something as simple as that, you just can't walk in and do that. You need to have a proper system, like somebody from, I don't know what that system is, but you need to have a system. And then women are not allowed, the NGOs are not allowed to have women employees, which means that essentially even that, you know, that access that those female households may have had, are you bothered because of this?
No.
Okay. So, the access that female households may have had through these NGO employees is also not there. So, these things we talked about and how they are providing the access, how are they ensuring that female households are receiving aid, how are female, women who have been hurt. So another interesting news piece that I read, I cannot verify, or because obviously I don't know, it's something I read, that a lot of the women who were under the rubble were left under the rubble because the men will not touch them. You know, so this just basically sums up for you what the situation is for women. Like, it transcends anything that we know in today's day and age, where the restrictions just reach a level where it's absolutely obnoxious. It just doesn't even make sense anymore. So when I speak to them, I report on their issues and I talk to them, each one of these conversations is really hard for me, because I don't know what to say to them. I don't know if anything is going to change, or if it will change anytime soon. I don't know if a country will take them in. Will there be a Germany or a US or a France or a Canada who will take them in? I cannot answer those questions for them. Sometimes they tell me they don't have food. Sometimes they tell me they don't have any studies. Sometimes they tell me they are going crazy sitting at home. I don't have any answers. It just affects me also. Like, I feel so helpless and I feel so futile, you know, what we are doing, because nothing is changing. The needle's not moving, you know. It's still there. 4 years later, 2021, we are exactly 4 years down the line. It has only gotten worse. And going back to that time, yes, when this whole fiasco was happening of the Americans leaving and the Taliban advancing towards the capital, it was 15th August. I think everything just came to head on that day when, and ironically, and this is also something I've spoken about a lot, ironically, I was sitting in the women's ministry. In the Ministry of Women's Affairs in Kabul, I had secured an interview with an executive director of a World Bank project, and she had been working for 10 years on the ground deep inside Afghanistan, empowering women to kind of be self-sustainable, convincing families, going deep inside their, you know, villages and households, and trying to convince the men of the house to allow women to sort of also contribute to the family, you know, rather than being just a receiver, let them be a provider as well. And they had begun to see those changes on the ground. More and more women were stepping up with skills. They were providing those skills. And now the World Bank was so happy that the project was being renewed, or it had already been renewed. I can't say for sure, but something like, it was a big project and she was super proud. She was talking about her achievements, and we are sitting in this ministry where I sort of leave my passport at the entry gate, because that was the requirement, like as an ID proof or something. And I'm sitting inside her big office and we are talking about it, and suddenly there is this whole commotion that breaks out. So then she calls in all her female colleagues and then she's like, we need to talk about the security situation. You know how things are. Taliban, tab tak, the news was that they are very close to the capital. You know, they were every day, every morning, we are talking about, अच्छा कितने दिन में आ जाएंगे. So ऐसे बात होती थी ना रोज की, कब आ जाएंगे. अभी लगता है कि अगर आ गए तो कितने दिन तक it will sustain, capital कितने दिन sustain करेगा. Will it be a week? Will it be 6 months? I thought fair estimate was 6 months. You know, the government will be able to hold for 6 months and then probably infighting will start, civil war situation will emerge, blah blah blah. Things were that, but ek bahut hi conservative estimate tha, 6 mahine tak they will be able to hold the capital. 15 August aata hai, सिक्योरिटी सिचुएशन हो रही है. कल तक 14th अगस्त की रात तक हमें ये पता चल गया था कि वो कैपिटल से सब अभी 100 किलोमीटर दूर बचे हैं. जितने भी बफर सिटीज थे दे हैव कैप्चर्ड. अब हम बैठे हैं वहां पे, वी आर डिस्कसिंग द सिक्योरिटी सिचुएशन विद अदर फीमेल एम्प्लॉइज, एंड सडनली, एंड आई एम टॉकिंग, मैंने कहा डू माइंड इफ आई जॉइन द ब्रीफिंग बिकॉज आई वुड लव टू टॉक टू दीज वुमेन एज वेल. And she said, yeah, for sure. And then I was sitting and I was talking to women. They were so proud that this is what we have achieved. And we are really proud for what we have achieved. You know, so many women and girls are now working, are supporting their families. And they were like, you know, really pepped up about it. And suddenly, bahar na afra-tafri shuru ho jati hai, corridor mein. And then she gets up and then somebody just bursts into the room. And because they were talking in Pashto or Dari, I couldn't tell. But they were talking in their tongue and I couldn't understand. All I could hear is, Taliban is here. They have entered the capital. And it was complete chaos. It was complete chaos from there. The women, they all just got up. Their notepads were in their laps. And, you know, unhone wo patka niche kya hua. And they all just started hugging and crying and howling. And I was like, I was dumbstruck. I was like, what the heck just happened? Like, I could not wrap my head around it. Ki ye kya hua ekdam se? Matlab, what just happened? Like, and these women are crying ki this is the end we were talking about, you know, like just 10 minute pehle hum ye baat kar rahe hain ki Taliban, humne itna kiya, hame yahi dar hai ki agar wo aa gaye to hamara sara jo bhi you know humne jitni mehnat kari hai it will all be for nothing. And the executive director, the woman, her name, I don't know if I should say her name, I'll say it anyway, but you can edit it out later maybe, Latifa. I was talking to Latifa and Latifa was very calm and like just, you know, the boss lady, and she was very calm and she's observing the whole situation. And somewhere between all this chaos, the sound came, we have an Indian here, we need to get her out immediately. You know, they just wanted to get rid of me. It's not like they were concerned about my safety, they wanted to get rid of me because Taliban is believed to be allied with Pakistan, and everybody was fearing ki hum ek Indian ko nahi rakh sakte abhi yahan pe. And मैं कहा अच्छा, suddenly वो attention मुझ पे आ गया, like कि she needs to go and she needs to get the hell out and needs to go really quickly. And like Latifa at that moment, she was like, thank God for her. She was very focused and she's like, no, I'll drop her back, bring her passport. And somebody brought my passport or I collected it from the gate, I can't remember, but I collected my passport from the gate. And then she dropped me, and we are watching this whole chaos unfold around us. Also, like, people are running on the streets, shuttering their shops, or sab jagah, matlab 2 kilometer ka distance tha wo udhar se mere ghar tak, ministry se, like to the apartment where I was staying. And it took us, I think, 25-30 minutes to get there, 2 kilometer distance. It was so crowded, people were going crazy. Aur hum, main khidki pe baith ke aise dekh rahi hu, Latifa is like very, you know, ekdam, she's sitting like, you know, bilkul, I think she was shell shocked, and she didn't know what to say or what to do. But she had that grace. I still remember her face. I mean, she was so poised in that entire situation, the way she handled her female staff, staying strong for them, staying strong for me. Who was I? I was just interviewing her. Like, you know, I was just a journalist in that room, and she took a stand for me and she said, no, I'm going to ensure that she is safely sent home. She dropped me home. मैं घर में गई. I used to live on the 9th floor. I stood there apartment window में. मैं नीचे देख रही हूँ अपनी विंडो से कि क्या चल रहा है यहाँ पे, और दूर मुझे दिख रहा है कहीं पे कुछ तो आग, मतलब धुआं निकल रहा है, बहुत सारे हेलीकॉप्टर्स उड़ रहे हैं. मतलब इट वॉज, आई हैव नेवर सीन एनीथिंग लाइक दैट. एंड देन द नेक्स्ट थिंग यू नो, 6 महीने छोड़ो तुम, 6 घंटे में वी हैड द न्यूज़ दैट, 6 घंटे भी नहीं, रादर like, you know, in a couple of hours we knew that the president has fled, the country has fallen. And I was like, ये हुआ क्या है पिछले 3-4 घंटे में. आई कुड नॉट रैप माई हेड अराउंड इट. इट वॉज एक्सपीरियंसिस आई हैव एवर हैड एंड इवन वेन आई एम टॉकिंग इट्स लाइक माई हार्ट इज थम्पिंग इन माई चेस्ट. इट्स जस्ट आई फील फॉर दोज वुमेन एवरी सिंगल डे. आई स्वेयर टू गॉड आई डोंट नो हाउ आई कैन. इट्स प्रोबेबली दैट्स व्हाई आई एम सो हेल बेंट ऑन कंटिन्यूइंग टू रिपोर्ट ऑन इट. लाइक आई एम नॉट गेटिंग माई परमिशन टू गो देयर. I am helpless sitting in Delhi. I could not even attend a press conference in Delhi. And yet I want to, because I've seen it. You know, I've seen it. If this was something I was reading, I was reporting on as a secondary, you know, second-hand information, तो आपका कोई अटैचमेंट नहीं होता. पर इस इशू के साथ अटैचमेंट है मुझे. वन, आई एम अ वुमन. टू, आई नो हाउ मच दे वर्क एंड हाउ वाइब्रेंट दीज लेडीज वर. आई हैव सीन इट एंड आई नो दैट एक्सेस और नो एक्सेस. आई जस्ट ऑलवेज कीप टॉकिंग अबाउट इट. No matter what.
So as a senior journalist whose main domains are conflicted areas or and gender, what are your next steps?
Oh, wow, thank you so much for this question. I think it's very important that we establish that. So one, I chose this niche for myself. I'm a freelancer. I could have chosen anything. I could have chosen entertainment. I could have chosen culture. I could have chosen literary, anything under the sun. But I chose conflict. Because I think a lot of the stories get lost in the political, you know, in that cacophony of political debates or political shouting or whatever. मतलब जो human stories हैं वो कहीं ना कहीं दब जाती हैं. आपको नहीं पता कि एक earthquake हुआ, 10,000 लोग मर गए. चलो ठीक है, ये तो news है, ये statistic है. पर एक अगर आप उसको zoom in करो to all the way down to that one family to understand what exactly has been lost. It's not just a home. They are currently living in displacement. They don't know when their homes will be rebuilt. They have no sources of income. They have 10 family members. Then you understand the true extent of the damage. Abhi aapko kya dikh raha hai? Ek statistic hai, aap usse bhul jaoge, aap usse connect bhi nahi kar paoge. And that was, I think, my objective when I entered this domain. And I'll be very honest, it's incredibly difficult. Not just because of the dangers that this niche brings in my field of work, but also because there is so much gatekeeping. There is just the gatekeeping is almost unbelievably difficult to breach. Matlab, for someone, I say I'm putting myself out there. I have the experience. Let me do it. Like whatever I know how to secure myself. Like I've been there. I've seen it. I've learned from my mistakes, and I know how I can secure myself. आप मुझे मौका तो दो, बट वो मौका भी मुझे नहीं मिल रहा है. सो आई फील दैट एज अ जर्नलिस्ट वी नीड टू डेमोक्रेटाइज दैट स्पेस. वी नीड टू ओपन इट अप मोर एंड मोर फॉर एवरीबडी रिगार्डलेस ऑफ देयर पासपोर्ट्स और जेंडर और देयर यू नो कास्ट क्रीड कलर वट एवर. दीज थिंग्स शुडंट मैटर. एंड आई थिंक दैट्स वेयर व्हेन आई वाज इन लेबनान द वे आई वाज रिसीव्ड बाय पीपल इन जनरल व्हिच वाज वेरी काइंड बट बाय अथॉरिटीज I felt कि शायद अगर if I were a Western journalist मेरे को शायद थोड़ा तवज्जो और मिलता जो मुझे नहीं मिला. ये मेरा मानना. I don't know this. I could be completely wrong, but this is something I felt that. And then I could not get the reporting permission. You know, like it was really sad that the stories I could have reported on in depth I could not. I only just met the diaspora that I knew from personal connections, and that's all the stuff I did. So as for plans, I think one is the fact that I launched a Substack where I'm talking more and more about how you know how South Asian journalists can work in more global environments, global spaces, and what kind of challenges. I don't claim to say that I know a lot, but I can speak from what I know, the experiences I've had, the mistakes you can avoid, and how you can secure permissions, how to get you know, letters and visas and whatnot. I mean, at least I can make it simpler in the countries that I have traveled. I mean, that's one thing that I have started. I want to talk to other journalists to understand what kind of challenges they face. Alongside that, I'm also launching a podcast. It's called The Unpopular Opinion. I think the one thing I've seen as a journalist in the last few years is that we've lost spaces where two very different opinions can coexist in the same space, because it almost always becomes like a, you know, screen fest. Someone A is shouting on B, B is shouting on A, and then eventually everybody gets cancelled. And I don't think that's a very fair or democratic way of sharing opinions. I mean, if there are going to be 7 billion people in this world, you cannot expect everybody to have the same beliefs and opinions. It's okay to have you know, different beliefs. And I want to create that space where somebody can also say something extreme that to a leftist brain would be completely obnoxious, versus someone who has a very good reasoning for why this is, why they are saying
there
is
no wrong or right.
There is no wrong or right, and let the reviewer decide which side they want to go on, at least, but from a position of knowledge.
So that's pretty exciting. I'm very happy. I love encouraging new things, and I love encouraging women doing new things. So I'm very happy that you started talking about this on my platform. I have goosebumps from all your stories.
Thank you.
I mean, I am out of words, which is hardly ever the case in my life. And I have a lot of respect for you.
Thank you.
As a journalist, as a woman, to go, and I know that sometimes we shouldn't keep highlighting gender women, but I think the fact of the matter is that we are subjected to a lot of hate and trolls, emotional, physical abuse, where we are slightly less underprivileged when it comes to men. And despite of all those odds, going to a place where women's rights is something that absolutely does not exist and unheard of, I must appreciate you, and I'm very grateful that you've come on this podcast. And we all get to celebrate you. My last question that I ask everybody is, what is the one advice that you'd like to give someone who wants to go beyond the border?
Go with an open heart and an open mind. You just allow different cultures to, you know, to give you that experience of what it's like to live in somebody else's shoes for a few days. Like, every time I have traveled outside of India, I have always welcomed different cultures. I have tried to respect their local, you know, traditions. And I've had some of the finest experiences just by keeping an open mind that this is what it is, and I'm going to embrace it. And I'm not going to impose my traditional beliefs on somebody. And it's been an excellent ride so far.
Well, thank you so much for coming on my podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for staying until the end. To help us continue these conversations, please subscribe on YouTube and like and follow on Instagram and Spotify.